Imagine you're driving like 80 miles an hour down a really crowded highway.
Oh, that sounds terrifying already.
Right, and your windshield is completely blacked out.
Wait, completely?
Completely. You cannot see what's in front of you at all. The only way you can steer the car is by staring intently into the rearview mirror.
Just looking at the skid marks you just left on the pavement.
Exactly. That terrifying scenario is basically how the Federal Reserve tries to steer the multi-trillion dollar U.S. economy using lagging indicators. Welcome to the deep dive.
It is a wild ride for sure.
It really is. Real quick, this deep dive is brought to you by CERT Fuel. They've got a full series 65 course with adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams weighted just like the real thing. Check it out at CERTFuel.com.
Highly recommend it if you want to pass.
Yeah. So, all right, grab your notes because today we are taking a massive deep dive into the economic frameworks you absolutely must master to crush the Series 65 exam.
And, you know, if you're taking the Series 65, you already understand that the stakes are incredibly high.
Oh, absolutely.
The goal here isn't to just read a textbook at you or, like, throw a list of isolated definitions your way.
Nobody learns that way, especially not us.
Right, because the exam writers are incredibly skilled at crafting questions that punish rote memorization. They want to see if you understand the underlying mechanics, the literal plumbing of the financial system.
Yeah, when they set a trap, and they will absolutely set traps, you need to understand the causality of the economy so well that the wrong answers simply look mathematically impossible to you.
Exactly. We have to focus on the why and the how behind every single rule.
And to make this stick, especially if you're, I don't know, walking the dog or pacing your living room right now, we are going to use active recall.
The best way to learn, honestly.
For sure. So throughout our conversation, we're going to just pause and throw a scenario directly at you. You need to think about the mechanics we just discussed, form the answer in your head, and then we'll break down the logic.
Active recall forces your brain to actually retrieve the information rather than just passively listening to us talk. It's the single most effective way to lock in complex, highly testable concepts.
So to bring these really abstract macroeconomic concepts down to earth, we're going to use three hypothetical characters.
I love these guys.
Yeah, they're great. They're going to live through every economic boom, bust, and policy change we discuss today. So first, we have Frank the founder.
Good old Frank.
Frank runs this massive manufacturing facility that produces, like, Bluetooth-enabled, self-heating coffee mugs.
Very niche, very high-tech.
Right. He is ambitious, a little chaotic, and heavily reliant on borrowing money to keep his assembly lines moving.
So Frank basically represents the corporate sector. He's the engine of agri supply, you know, constantly balancing his inventory, his workforce, and the cost of capital.
Exactly. Then we have cautious Carla.
Ah, Carla.
Carla is a retired investor living on a fixed income annuity. She watches her portfolio obsessively. She maintains a detailed spreadsheet tracking the price of a dozen eggs.
Oh, she definitely has color-coded spreadsheets.
100%. And her absolute biggest fear in life is outliving her money because her purchasing power has eroded.
Because Carla is the human face of inflation risk and market fear.
Yep. And our third character is Desperate Dan.
Poor Dan.
Poor Dan is a regular guy who just always seems to be looking for a job or trying to secure a bank loan at the exact wrong time in the economic cycle.
He has terrible timing. He is completely at the mercy of the macroeconomic winds.
So Frank, Carla, and Dan are our tour guides today. Everything we analyze is going to happen to them.
Because every decision Frank makes about hiring Dan and every single fluctuation in Carla's bond portfolio is dictated by the environment they're operating in.
And the foundation of that environment is the business cycle, right?
Right. It's the natural heartbeat of the capitalist system. Every single economic indicator, every Federal Reserve policy, and every investment strategy on the exam relates back to where we currently sit in this recurring pattern.
So let's trace that heartbeat. It's not random. It moves through four distinct stages in a very specific chronological order.
And you have to know the order.
You have to. The acronym to remember is TEPC. TEPC.
Trough, expansion, peak, contraction.
Exactly. So if you visualize a wave on a graph, the trough is the absolute bottom. Expansion is the upward slope. The peak is the crest of the wave. And contraction is the downward slope back to the bottom.
Let's place Frank the founder at the trough. The bottom of the cycle is a really bleak place.
It's terrible. Economic activity has just bottomed out. Frank's factory is practically abandoned.
He's turned off the machines to save on electricity, and he's basically surviving on instant ramen.
Right, and unemployment across the economy is exceptionally high, which means Desperate Dan has been sending out resumes for months with zero callbacks.
And at this point, at the trough, interest rates are usually sitting at rock bottom because the demand for borrowing money is just non-existent. Nobody wants a loan.
But eventually, at the very bottom, consumer confidence just stops falling. Someone, somewhere, decides they want a warm cup of coffee and they buy one of Frank's mugs.
And that single purchase starts the flywheel.
Yes. We move into the E in TEPPC expansion. The economy gains momentum.
So Frank realizes, oh wow, my existing inventory is gone. I need to manufacture more mugs. He turns the machines back on.
But he needs someone to run them, so he posts a job listing. Desperate Dan gets the call, gets hired, and suddenly has a steady paycheck.
And Dan uses that paycheck to buy groceries, maybe a new car, which then stimulates other businesses.
During an expansion, the metrics are just overwhelmingly positive. Corporate earnings are rising, real estate prices are climbing, and the gross domestic product GDP is trending steadily upward.
Businesses are investing in capital equipment, and consumer demand is really robust. Frank might even go to the bank to take out a loan to buy a second manufacturing facility because business is just so good.
It feels like this upward trajectory should last forever,
It does feel like that, but mathematically, it just cannot.
right? No. We inevitably hit the peak, the absolute top of the roller coaster.
So Frank's factory is now running 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. He has three shifts of workers. He's paying Dan massive amounts of overtime.
He literally cannot squeeze one more Bluetooth mug out of his assembly line. But here is the critical mechanism you must understand for the exam. The peak is also when inflation is at its absolute highest.
Wait, if the peak is the top, why is that when inflation is highest? Shouldn't high inflation be bad?
That's a great question, and the mechanics of an overheating economy are fascinating. At the peak, you have maximum employment. Every single person who wants a job has one.
Right, Dan has maximum disposable income.
Exactly. So consumer demand is incredibly high. Everyone wants to buy a self-heating mug. But Frank's factory is maxed out. Supply is strictly capped by physical reality.
And when you have an ocean of money chasing a very limited pool of goods, the only possible release valve is price.
Frank looks at the massive line of customers out his door and realizes, hey, I can charge $40 for a mug instead of 20.
And his suppliers realize the exact same thing, so they double the price of the microchips and the plastic they sell to Frank.
Right, and then Dan realizes his groceries are twice as expensive, so he goes to Frank and demands a massive wage increase just to survive.
This is the spiral of inflation. The economy is running so hot that it basically begins to consume itself.
Which brings us to the inevitable C in TEPPC contraction, the downward slope. Prices simply get too high at the peak.
Yeah. Cautious Carla walks into the store, sees a $40 self-heating mug, and decides she'll just use her microwave.
Yep, the consumer balks. Demand falls off a cliff. But Frank's factory is still churning out thousands of mugs a day.
So suddenly his warehouse is just overflowing with unsold inventory.
Frank panics. He has to cut costs immediately. He stops all overtime. He turns off half the machines. And tragically, he hands Desperate Dan a pink slip.
Dan is unemployed again. Back to square one.
During a contraction, GDP growth turns negative. Corporate earnings plummet. But interestingly, inflation finally starts to cool down.
Because Frank has to slash the price of his mugs just to get rid of the excess inventory.
Right. And the economy continues to shrink, basically scraping away the excesses of the peak until it hits the trough and the wheel turns again.
The exam writers love to test your precise understanding of the contraction phase. They will try to confuse a temporary dip with a structural decline.
Okay, let's put that to the test right now with our first active recall question.
Get ready.
Think about the scenario. You are looking at economic data. The gross domestic product has been shrinking, completely negative, for exactly one quarter. So 3 months of negative growth. Are we officially in a recession?
We're going to pause for 3 seconds. Answer it in your head.
No. A recession requires two consecutive quarters of declining GDP.
Yeah, if you said yes, you fell for a classic trap. One quarter is just a bad 3 months. You need 2 quarters. That's 6 months of the economy shrinking.
The duration is the key differentiator. If things continue to deteriorate far beyond a standard recession, we enter a depression.
And a depression is defined mathematically as a decline in real GDP lasting at least 6 consecutive quarters.
That's 18 months of negative growth. You must hardwire those thresholds into your brain. Recession equals 2 quarters or 6 months. Depression equals 6 quarters or 18 months.
And here is another huge gotcha warning. The exam will give you a scenario describing an economy at its absolute peak and ask you to identify the true statement. One of the options will inevitably say GDP has turned negative.
Do not click that option. At the absolute peak of the business cycle, GDP is still positive. It's still growing.
It's just growing at a much slower rate than it was during the middle of the expansion. The peak is the split second before growth turns negative.
Right. Contraction is when the negative numbers actually appear. Don't let the exam trick you into thinking a peak means negative GDP.
So bringing this back to cautious Carla, who holds a diversified portfolio of stocks and bonds, how does this macroeconomic heartbeat actually affect her account statements?
Well, the stock market is a discounting mechanism. It is inherently forward-looking.
Right. Investors aren't pricing stocks based on what Frank's Factory is doing today. They're pricing stocks based on what they believe Frank's Factory will be doing 6 to 9 months from now.
Therefore, the stock market leads the cycle. Carla will see her equity portfolio start to lose value while Frank is still at the peak, totally oblivious to the coming contraction.
The market tops out before the economy tops out, and the market hits bottom before the economy hits the trough.
Okay, so stocks look ahead. But what about her bonds?
Bonds.
Rewind sound effect.
Wait.
No sound effects allowed, but imagine a record scratch right here. We need to establish an unbreakable rule right now, a mechanical law of finance that will dictate the rest of our discussion.
Listen closely to this one.
Bond prices and interest rates have an absolute mathematical inverse relationship.
They operate on a seesaw. When interest rates in the broader economy go up, the market price of existing outstanding bonds goes down.
And conversely, when interest rates drop, the market price of those existing bonds goes up.
We will dive deep into the actual mathematics of why that happens later. But for now, just visualize the cycle. During an expansion, the economy is heating up, inflation is rising, and interest rates are generally trending upward.
Therefore, the prices of existing bonds are falling.
And during a contraction, demand dries up, rates fall, and the prices of existing bonds rise.
Okay, so if the business cycle is the heartbeat of this entire system, the economic indicators are the vital monitors we hook the patient up to so we can diagnose exactly what the heart is doing.
And the Series 65 classifies these indicators into three distinct categories based entirely on their timing relative to the business cycle: leading, coincident, and lagging.
I love the car analogy for this. Let's go back to driving down the highway of the economy. Leading indicators are like looking out your windshield.
They show you the curves in the road before you actually reach them. They shift direction before the overall economy shifts.
Building permits are the perfect mechanical example of a leading indicator.
Right. Because if Frank wants to build a second manufacturing plant, he can't just start pouring concrete today.
No, he has to apply for zoning and pull municipal building permits. This happens months before he ever buys steel or hires a single construction worker.
So if the government reports a massive spike in building permits issued today, it basically guarantees a surge of construction jobs and materials purchasing in the near future. It looks out the windshield.
The stock market, specifically the S&P 500, operates the exact same way. We just established it leads the cycle by pricing in future earnings.
The M2 money supply is also leading because, you know, an injection of cash into the banking system takes time to actually filter out into business loans and consumer spending.
You'll also see new orders for consumer goods classified as a leading indicator. If a major retail chain places a massive order for 1 million of Frank's mugs, that order happens today. But Frank will be ramping up production for the next 3 months to fulfill it.
That's the windshield. Now let's look at coincident indicators. This is your speedometer.
A speedometer doesn't tell you what your speed will be in 5 miles, and it doesn't care what your speed was 5 miles ago.
It tells you exactly how fast the car is moving, right this exact second. They change direction at the same time the overall economy does.
And the ultimate coincident indicator is the gross domestic product itself, GDP. It's a snapshot of current economic output.
Industrial production is another one. It measures the physical volume of stuff rolling off Frank's assembly line today.
Personal income is coincident. So is non-agricultural employment, meaning how many people are currently sitting at a desk or standing on a factory floor at this moment.
So we have the windshield, we have the speedometer. Finally, we have lagging indicators. These are the rearview mirror.
They tell you about the road you just traveled. They change direction only after the overall economy has already shifted.
Corporate profits are a classic lagging indicator. Frank doesn't know his exact profit margin for the peak of the cycle until the quarter ends. His accountants reconcile the books, calculate depreciation, pay taxes, and finally issue a report.
The peak happened in the past. The profit report confirms it later.
The prime rate that banks charge their best customers is also lagging, because banks wait for the dust to settle before they adjust their foundational lending rates.
Okay, here is where the exam writers set their absolute most devious trap.
Oh, this one gets everybody.
It involves Desperate Dan and unemployment. They will use the word unemployment in a question and force you to categorize it. But wait, unemployment is unemployment, right? Correct. How can it be different indicators?
Because the timing of Dan losing his job is a multi-step process. Think about the actual mechanics of a layoff. Frank realizes a contraction has started. He fires Dan.
The very first thing Dan does, usual that same week, is go to the state workforce agency and file paperwork to receive unemployment benefits.
That specific action is called an initial unemployment claim.
And because it's the very first domino to fall when things get bad, initial unemployment claims act as a leading indicator. A sudden spike in initial claims tells us the economy is just starting to hit the brakes.
That's exactly right. But now, fast forward 6 months, Dan has been out of work this entire time.
The overall unemployment rate, which calculates the total percentage of the labor force that is jobless and the average duration of how long they've been unemployed, takes many months to build up.
Yeah, companies are really slow to fire workers, hoping things improve, and they're incredibly slow to hire them back, waiting for absolute proof that the expansion is real.
So the overarching unemployment rate and the average duration of unemployment are lagging indicators.
If you see initial claims, think leading. If you see duration or overall rate, think lagging. And remember, non-farm payrolls, which is just who is working right now, is coincident.
Let's do another active recall pause.
Get ready.
Think about the Consumer Price Index, the CPI, which measures inflation for services. If prices go up because of an overheating economy, do we know about it before it happens, while it happens, or after it happens? Is CPI a leading, coincident, or lagging indicator?
And say again.
If you reasoned that we only know the exact inflation data after the prices have already been raised and recorded, you are correct. CPI for services is a lagging indicator.
And while we're looking at the dashboard, we must dissect the speedometer itself, GDP. You have to understand the formula, not just memorize the letters.
The formula is C plus I plus G plus the quantity of X minus M.
Let's translate that alphabet soup into reality. GDP is the total market value of all final goods and services produced within a country's borders in a given year.
Okay, so C stands for consumer spending. That's Carla going to the store and buying groceries. This makes up the massive majority of the U.S. economy.
I is business investment. This is Frank purchasing a new $500,000 robotic system for his factory floor.
G is government spending. Congress funding a new interstate highway system or buying military aircraft.
And the final piece in parentheses is X minus Mnet exports. We take the value of everything we export to the rest of the world, and we subtract the value of everything we import.
The word doing the absolute most heavy lifting in the GDP definition is final. The total market value of all final goods. Why is that distinction the difference between passing and failing a question?
Because it prevents double counting, which would render the GDP metric completely useless.
Right. Frank, the founder, buys raw plastic pellets from a chemical company. He buys microchips from a tech supplier, and he buys cardboard boxes from a packaging plant.
If we counted the sale of the plastic, the sale of the chips, the sale of the box, and then also counted the sale of the final assembled self-heating mug to Carla, we would be counting the value of that plastic twice.
GDP only measures the final retail sale to the end user. Intermediate goods are strictly excluded.
We also have to account for the funhouse mirror of inflation. If Frank sells 1 million mugs this year at $20 each, his contribution to GDP is $20 million.
But if inflation hits, and next year he sells the exact same 1 million mugs, but he has to charge $40 each, his contribution to GDP is $40 million.
It looks like his economic output doubled, but he didn't actually produce a single extra mug.
This is why economists differentiate between nominal GDP and real GDP.
Nominal GDP is the raw data, distorted by the funhouse mirror of inflation. Real GDP strips out the effects of inflation.
It uses a constant dollar value so we can measure whether the actual physical volume of goods being produced is growing, or if the tape measure itself is just changing size. The exam will expect you to know that real GDP is the accurate measure of economic growth.
Now let's zoom in on the human element behind these numbers. When real GDP falls, Desperate Dan usually loses his job.
Since we just talked about employment data, let's look at the actual reasons Dan keeps losing his job, because the exam will definitely test you on the causes of unemployment. They classify unemployment into four distinct types:
frictional, structural, seasonal, and cyclical.
Let's run Dan through all four scenarios. The first is frictional unemployment.
The concept of friction implies the natural resistance of moving parts. In a free labor market, people are always moving.
Imagine Dan is currently employed by Frank, but he just hates his manager and the commute is an hour long. Dan voluntarily resigns to spend a month interviewing for a better position closer to home.
During that month, he is frictionally unemployed. It's short-term, it's transitional, and is largely voluntary. It exists even when the economy is booming.
Okay, now let's fundamentally change the foundation of Dan's career. Structural unemployment. This is long-lasting and severe.
Frank, the founder, realizes his labor costs are eating into his margins. So he purchases a highly advanced AI robotic system that can assemble mugs twice as fast as a human.
Dan's specific skill set assembling mugs by hand is basically no longer required by the economy.
Dan can't just walk across the street to a competitor because they all bought the exact same robots. His skills are structurally obsolete.
He will remain unemployed until he goes back to school and learns how to program or repair the very robots that replaced him. Structural unemployment is a fundamental mismatch of skills.
The third type is seasonal unemployment. This is the most predictable. It's tied strictly to the calendar.
Dan gets a job as a mall Santa, but he is obviously fired in January. Or he takes a job as a ski instructor, and when the snow melts, he's let go. It has nothing to do with robots or a recession.
Right. Which brings us to the most dangerous type, the one connected directly to the business cycle: cyclical unemployment.
The economy enters a contraction phase, demand plummets, consumers stop spending, Frank's inventory piles up.
Because there is a massive drop in aggregate demand, Frank simply doesn't have the revenue to support his payroll. He lays Dan off.
Dan is cyclically unemployed. He wants to work, he has the right skills, but the macroeconomic environment is just too sick to provide a job.
This sets up a classic exam trap involving the phrase, the natural rate of unemployment.
Oh man, the exam loves this one. The trap assumes you will look at that phrase and think it means 0% unemployment.
But in a dynamic capitalist system, unemployment can never realistically be 0%. People will always be quitting to find better jobs, which is frictional. And technology will always be advancing, displacing some workers, which is structural.
Therefore, economists define the natural rate of unemployment as frictional unemployment plus structural unemployment.
Notice what is explicitly missing from that equation: cyclical unemployment.
The exam will try to trick you. They will give you a list and ask what comprises the natural rate. Cyclical unemployment is unnatural. It is a result of an economic sickness.
Let's do a quick active recall scenario.
Okay, you're listening. Think about this. If we are in a severe recession, which type of unemployment spikes the most?
Pause for a beat.
Cyclical. It's tied directly to the business cycle.
Now let's pivot from the sickness of a contraction to the sickness of an overheating peak: inflation.
We defined it earlier as a sustained increase in general price levels, but we need to explore exactly how this destroys wealth, particularly for cautious Carla.
Right, because Carla is retired. She does not have an employer who gives her a cost of living adjustment every year.
She invested her life savings into a fixed annuity that pays her exactly $3,000 on the first of every month. 10 years ago, $3,000 covered her mortgage, her groceries, her utilities, and left enough for a nice vacation.
But if inflation runs at 5% a year, the cost of her groceries and utilities compounds annually.
10 years later, that exact same $3,000 check barely covers her basic living expenses.
Inflation silently vaporizes the purchasing power of fixed income investors. This is why Carla is terrified of it. It destroys lenders, because the dollars they are paid back in the future buy significantly less than the dollars they originally lent out.
But conversely, if inflation destroys lenders, it is a massive windfall for borrowers.
Think about Frank the founder. He borrowed $5 million to build his factory on a 30-year fixed loan.
As inflation runs rampant, the price of his mugs doubles. His revenue doubles. It becomes incredibly easy for him to generate dollars.
But his bank loan payment remains exactly the same. He gets to pay back his past debt with future dollars that are far easier to acquire and worth far less.
Now let's look at the inverse phenomena: deflation, a sustained decrease in general price levels. Money actually becomes worth more over time.
A mug that costs $20 today might cost $15 next month. On a micro level, consumers think falling prices are wonderful.
But on a macro level, deflation is a catastrophic economic sickness. Think about the psychology of deflation. If you know that a new truck is going to be 10% cheaper in 6 months, you are not going to buy it today.
You defer your consumption. But if millions of consumers defer their consumption, Frank sells zero trucks today. He had zero revenue. So he fires Dan.
Now Dan has no income, so he can't pay his mortgage. The bank forecloses on Dan's house. Deflation triggers a terrifying downward spiral of collapsing demand and mass defaults.
Because the terminology is tricky, the exam will test your ability to distinguish between deflation and disinflation. I insist on a clear distinction because this is a massive exam trap.
Let's bring back the car analogy. You are driving 80 miles an hour. That is high inflation. Prices are rising rapidly. If you take your foot off the gas pedal and the car slows down to 40 miles an hour, you're still moving forward. You are still covering ground. That is disinflation.
The inflation rate dropped from, say, 5% to 2%. Prices are still going up, just at a slower pace.
But if you stop the car, put it in reverse, and start driving backward, that is deflation. The inflation rate is negative. Prices are actually going down.
So if you see a scenario where the CPI was 6% last year and it's 3% this year, the phenomenon is disinflation.
And speaking of CPI, what happens when we experience the absolute worst case scenario? Stagflation.
Stagflation breaks all the traditional rules. Normally, high inflation happens when the economy is booming, and high unemployment happens when the economy is shrinking.
Stagflation is the nightmare combination of both. You have a stagnant, non-growing economy with high unemployment paired with rampant high inflation. The 1970s oil crisis is the classic textbook example.
It is incredibly difficult for policymakers to fix because the medicine for one symptom exacerbates the other.
Which perfectly introduces the policymakers themselves. When the economy is sick with inflation or a recession, who are the doctors and what medicine do they prescribe?
If you take nothing else away from this discussion, burn this rule into your memory. There are two completely different doctors.
You work in different hospitals, they use completely different tools, and they do not mix them up on the exam.
The two doctors are the federal government, meaning Congress, and the president, and the Federal Reserve, which is the central bank.
Let's start with the government. Their toolkit is called fiscal policy. Congress and the president only have two primary levers they can pull: taxes and government spending. That's it.
Let's say the economy is in a deep trough. Dan is unemployed, Frank's factory is idle. Congress wants to prescribe expansionary fiscal policy or stimulus to help the economy. What do they do?
They cut taxes. This leaves more money in Carla and Dan's pockets, hoping they'll go out and spend it on Frank's mugs.
Simultaneously, they increase government spending. Congress passes a massive infrastructure bill to build a new nationwide high-speed rail system.
They hand billion-dollar contracts to construction companies who immediately hire thousands of workers like Dan.
But let's look at the math of expansionary fiscal policy. If Congress is cutting taxes, taking in less revenue, but increasing spending by trillions of dollars to build trains, they are spending money they do not have.
This results in a budget deficit. Expansionary fiscal policy almost always creates a deficit.
Conversely, if the economy is at a peak, cooling is needed. Congress prescribes contractionary fiscal policy.
They raise taxes, actively pulling money out of the private sector so consumers can't spend it, and they cut government spending, halting the high-speed rail projects.
This cools the economy down and logically results in a budget surplus.
Now let's take a deep dive into a highly testable side effect of expansionary fiscal policy. It's called the crowding out effect.
When Congress runs a massive trillion-dollar deficit, they don't just print the money out of thin air, they have to borrow it. They do this by issuing treasury bonds to the financial markets.
But there is a finite pool of loanable funds in the global financial system. Imagine the pool of loanable funds as a massive municipal water tank supplying a town.
Right, and Frank, the founder, wants to build a new factory. So he hooks up his little garden hose to the tank to get a small business loan.
But suddenly, the federal government rolls up and hooks a massive industrial fire hose to the water tank to fund their trillion-dollar deficit.
The government's demand for cash is so astronomically high that it drops the water pressure for everyone else. They literally suck up all the available lending cash.
Because the demand for loans is so high, the price of borrowing money, which is the interest rate, skyrockets.
Frank looks at his garden hose, sees the new massive interest rate, and realizes he cannot afford to borrow the money anymore.
Frank cancels the new factory. The government's massive borrowing has driven up interest rates and crowded out private businesses from accessing capital. the public sector expands at the direct expense of the private sector. That is the crowding out effect.
Before we move to the second doctor, let's test this with an active recall question.
Okay. The exam presents a scenario where the Federal Reserve decides to lower corporate income taxes to stimulate growth. What is the result?
Think about it.
The result is that it's a trick question. The Fed has nothing to do with taxes.
Congress has nothing to do with the money supply. Keep them separate. Only Congress controls fiscal policy.
The second doctor is the Federal Reserve. Their toolkit is called monetary policy.
They don't pass laws, they don't build high-speed rail, and they do not tax you. Their goal from Congress is maximum employment and stable prices, which usually means a 2% inflation target.
They manage the economy's vital signs by controlling the money supply and influencing interest rates. They have four specific tools. The acronym to lock this in is DORM, D-O-R-M.
Let's walk through the DORM. D is the discount rate. O is open market operations, or FOMOs. R is reserve requirements. M is margin, specifically regulation T.
Let's dissect the discount rate first, because there is a massive point of confusion here regarding the federal funds rate.
The discount rate is the interest rate the Federal Reserve charges commercial banks when those banks borrow money directly from the Fed's lending window.
The Fed directly controls this rate. It's their internal price of money.
However, the federal funds rate is the rate that commercial banks charge each other for overnight unsecured loans to meet their reserve requirements.
This is the trap. The Fed does not directly set the federal funds rate. They cannot mandate what JP Morgan charges Bank of America.
They can only set a target for the Fed funds rate and then use their other tools to manipulate the market until the rate hits that target. But they explicitly, directly dictate the discount rate.
Now for the O in DORM, open market operations. This is the heavy artillery. It's the most frequently used tool of the Fed.
This involves the Fed buying or selling U.S. government securities, like treasury bonds, on the open market.
The mechanics of this require some mental gymnastics, so let's break down the exact flow of cash with an active recall question.
Think about a commercial bank. Their balance sheet is full of government bonds. The Federal Reserve wants to stimulate a sick contracting economy. They want expansionary monetary policy.
Will they buy government securities or sell government securities?
Wait a second. Yeah.
The BUY securities. Think about the flow of cash.
Let's trace the mechanism. The Fed goes to the commercial bank and says, we are buying those treasury bonds from you. The Fed takes the illiquid paper bonds onto their own balance sheet.
In exchange, the Fed credits the bank's reserve account with liquid cash. They literally create the reserves out of thin air.
Suddenly, the commercial bank has a vault overflowing with cash. But cash sitting in a vault earns zero yield, and banks are businesses that exist to make a profit.
They're highly incentivized to get that cash out the door. So they call Desperate Dan and offer him a cheap mortgage. They call Frank and offer him a low-interest business loan.
By buying bonds, the Fed hands cash to the banks, pumping money into the economy, expanding the money supply, and driving down interest rates.
Buy to stimulate. But what if the economy is overheating with peak inflation?
The Fed uses contractionary monetary policy. They do the exact opposite. They sell bonds.
The Fed hands the paper bonds back to the banks, and in return, they drain the liquid cash out of the bank's reserve accounts.
Now the banks have no excess cash to lend. They tighten their lending standards, interest rates shoot up, Frank can't get a loan, and the economy slows down.
So it'll shrink. Okay, what about the R and the M?
R is the reserve requirement. The Fed dictates exactly what percentage of a bank's deposits must be locked in the vault and cannot be lent out.
If the Fed lowers the requirement from 10% to 5%, they instantly free up billions of dollars in bank reserves, which are then lent out, multiplying through the economy.
If they raise the requirement, they lock up cash. It's a very blunt instrument, so it's rarely changed.
Finally, M is margin, specifically regulation T. This dictates how much money an investor can borrow from their broker to purchase securities.
It's been set at 50% for decades. If the Fed wanted to cool down rampant speculation in the stock market, they could raise the margin requirement to 70%, forcing investors to use more of their own cash.
When the Fed pulls those monetary levers, the immediate ripple effect is felt in interest rates. And as we established earlier, interest rates dictate everything about bond pricing.
We said earlier that bond prices and interest rates are on a seesaw. If rates go up, prices go down. Let's finally explain the mathematical why behind that rule.
Karsha's Carla bought a 10-year U.S. Treasury bond last year. It pays her exactly 3% interest annually. At the time, that was a great rate.
But today, the Federal Reserve uses contractionary monetary policy. They sell bonds, drain cash, and interest rates across the economy spike. Now, the U.S. Treasury is issuing brand new 10-year bonds that pay 5% interest.
Carla suddenly has a medical emergency and needs cash. She goes to the secondary bond market to sell her 3% bond.
But she runs into a wall of pure logic. Why would any rational investor buy Carla's bond that pays 3% when they could buy a brand new bond from the government that pays 5%?
They absolutely will not, unless Carla makes a major concession. She has to slash the asking price of her bond.
She has to sell her $1,000 bond at a steep discount, say, for $800.
By buying the bond at a discount, the new investor's total return, factoring in the cheaper price and the 3% coupon, will mathematically equal the new 5% market rate.
The rising interest rate mathematically forced the market price of Carla's existing bond to plummet.
Now we have to tackle what is arguably the ultimate brain bender on the Series 65. I admit this concept always trips people up. It's the difference between rate volatility and price volatility across the yield curve.
It trips up almost everyone. There are two ends of the bond timeline. Short-term bonds, maturing in a few months or a year, and long-term bonds, maturing in 20 or 30 years.
Here are the two rules you must memorize, and then we'll explain why they exist. Rule 1, short-term rates are more volatile than long-term rates.
Rule 2, long-term bond prices are more volatile than short-term bond prices.
Let's take rule 1. Why do short-term interest rates bounce up and down so violently?
Because the tools the Federal Reserve uses, the discount rate and the federal funds rate target, are overnight lending rates. They are the shortest of the short term.
The Fed manipulates the short end of the curve directly and frequently at their policy meetings.
But a 30-year interest rate reflects the market's aggregate expectation of inflation and growth over three decades. It moves slowly, like a massive ocean liner. Short-term rates are a speedboat bouncing on the waves.
But when we look at the actual market value, the prices of the bonds, the behavior reverses. Long-term bond prices are wildly volatile, while short-term bond prices barely move. Why?
The mechanism is a concept called duration. It measures a bond's price sensitivity to a 1% change in interest rates. Think about the math of being trapped.
Suppose you own a one-year bond paying 3% and market rates suddenly jump to 5%. You are missing out on 2% interest.
On a $1,000 bond, that's $20 you're losing out on. The price of your bond drops by about $20. You suffer for 1 year, the bond matures, you get your $1,000 back, and you reinvest at the new high rate.
A $20 price drop is barely a blip. But what if Carla owns a 30-year bond at 3% and rates jump to 5%?
She is completely trapped.
Yeah.
A long-term bond has more years of cash flows trapped at the old rate.
Yeah.
She's missing out on that $20 a year every single year for 30 years.
That is $600 of missed interest over the life of the bond. To convince a new buyer to take on that awful 30-year trap, Carla has to discount the price of her bond massively.
Duration equals structural pain. The longer the maturity, the more years of cash flows get crushed by an adverse rate change. Therefore, long-term bond prices are highly volatile.
Let's lock this in with a direct question.
Listen up.
The Federal Reserve suddenly hikes interest rates to fight peak inflation. You open your brokerage app. Which bond's market price will have dropped the hardest? A 2-year treasury note? Or a 30-year treasury bond?
Think about it.
The 30-year bond. Long-term prices are more volatile.
Now, if we take all these varying interest rates across different maturities, from 1 month all the way out to 30 years, and plot them on a graph, we get a yield curve.
The shape of this curve is one of the most reliable macroeconomic crystal balls in existence. Let's analyze the shapes. First, a normal yield curve.
A normal yield curve slopes upward from left to right. It indicates that long-term interest rates are higher than short-term interest rates.
Mathematically, this makes perfect sense. If you lock your money up for 10 years, you are taking on more inflation risk and opportunity cost than if you lock it up for 10 days.
You demand a higher yield to compensate for the passage of time. A normal upward curve signals a healthy, expanding economy.
What if the curve is steep, meaning it points very sharply upward?
A steep curve typically occurs at the trough of the business cycle, right as we exit a recession. The Fed has slashed short-term rates to near zero to stimulate borrowing.
But bond investors, looking ahead, expect the stimulus to work, causing a strong economic expansion and eventual inflation. So they demand high, long-term yields.
Next is a flat curve. Short-term rates and long-term rates are roughly equal. The yield curve has just flattened out.
This represents an inflection point. The market is incredibly uncertain. The economy is likely transitioning either from expansion into contraction or vice versa.
And finally, the most notorious shape in all of finance, the inverted yield curve. It slopes downward. Short-term interest rates are actually paying a higher yield than long-term interest rates.
Why is this so terrifying? If you see an inverted yield curve on the exam, you need to immediately associate it with one word, recession. It is the ultimate recessionary warning siren.
It has preceded the last 8 recessions. You have to memorize this. It happens when the Fed has aggressively hiked short-term rates to choke off inflation at the peak.
However, institutional bond investors believe the Fed is squeezing too hard, and their tight monetary policy is going to choke the economy to death, forcing a recession.
In a panic, investors want to lock in safe long-term yields before the crash happens and rates fall. So they stampede into 10-year and 30-year treasury bonds.
This massive wave of buying drives the price of long-term bonds up. And since price and yield are inversely related, it drives the long-term yield down, pushing it below the short-term rates.
While we're looking at the bond market, we must differentiate between U.S. Treasuries, which are considered free of default risk, and corporate bonds, which are not.
Frank, the founder, issues corporate bonds to fund his factory. There is a very real chance Frank makes bad decisions, his factory goes bankrupt, and he defaults on his debt.
Because of that risk, investors demand a higher yield to lend money to Frank than they do to lend money to the U.S. government.
That numerical difference in yield is called the credit spread. If a 10-year treasury pays 4% and Frank's 10-year corporate bond pays 6%, the credit spread is 2%.
That spread acts as a real-time psychological barometer for the economy. Think about an expansion phase.
Frank is selling millions of mugs. His balance sheet is flawless. Investors feel incredibly confident that Frank will easily pay back his debts.
Because they perceive the risk is very low, they're willing to accept a lower yield on his bonds. The credit spread narrows. The gap shrinks.
But when we enter a contraction, fear takes over. Investors see Frank's unsold inventory. They read reports of mass layoffs. They start to panic that Frank might go bankrupt.
To convince anyone to buy Frank's bonds in a terrifying economic environment, the yield has to skyrocket to 8 or 10% to compensate for the massive risk. Therefore, the credit spread widens.
Narrowing spreads indicate economic confidence. Widening spreads indicate severe economic fear and an approaching contraction.
Do not confuse the yield curve, which measures time, with credit spreads, which measure fear and default risk.
Okay, we've spent this entire time analyzing the domestic economy, but Frank, the founder, exports his widgets globally, and cautious Carla buys international stocks to diversify her portfolio.
We have to look at international borders. When money crosses borders, it introduces a completely new set of macroeconomic variables.
The most immediate factor is currency valuation or exchange rate risk.
When you invest in a foreign asset, your return isn't just based on how the asset performs. It is heavily dictated by how the foreign currency performs relative to the U.S. dollar.
Let's walk Carla through this math. Carla decides she wants exposure to European markets. She wants to buy stock in a German manufacturing company. The stock trades on a European exchange and is priced strictly in euros.
Carla takes 10,000 U.S. dollars. She converts them into euros at the current exchange rate. And she buys the stock.
Over the next year, the German company does incredibly well. The stock goes up 10% in value on the European exchange. Carla is thrilled.
But her game is an illusion until the money is repatriated. Carla lives in America. She cannot buy her groceries in euros.
She has to sell the German stock, take her pile of euros, and convert them back into US dollars.
Here is where the macroeconomic winds can destroy her. What if, during that year, the U.S. dollar became significantly stronger compared to the euro?
This is a gotcha warning. A strong U.S. dollar sounds patriotic, right? It sounds like a good thing. But for a U.S. investor holding foreign assets, a strong dollar is devastating.
If the U.S. dollar strengthens, it means the euro has fundamentally weakened. When Carla takes her pile of weak euros to the currency exchange desk, they possess very little purchasing power.
They buy very few strong U.S. dollars. The brutal exchange rate completely vaporizes her 10% market gain. A strong dollar mathematically decreases the return of foreign investments when converted back to U.S. currency.
Conversely, a weak U.S. dollar is fantastic for foreign investments. If the dollar weakens, Carla's euros are now comparatively very strong.
They command a massive premium. When she converts them back, her weak dollar returns are supercharged.
Let's solidify this with a direct question to you, the listener.
You hold a portfolio of Japanese equities. Over the last 6 months, you read in the financial news that the U.S. dollar has weakened significantly against the Japanese yen. Are you happy or sad about this currency movement?
Pause for a second.
You are incredibly happy. A weak dollar boosts your foreign returns.
This exchange rate volatility is a form of systematic risk. You cannot diversify away from it simply by buying 20 different European companies instead of one, because they are all fundamentally priced in the exact same euro.
On a macroeconomic scale, countries must track these massive flows of money crossing their borders. This accounting ledger is called the balance of payments.
I want to spend some time here because people constantly confuse the balance of payments with the trade deficit. They are entirely different scopes.
Let's clarify the difference. The balance of payments is the master accounting record. It tracks every single economic transaction between the entities of one country and the rest of the world over a given period.
It is divided into two primary subaccounts, the current account and the financial account, which older texts sometimes call the capital account.
Let's define the current account first. The current account tracks the day-to-day trade of physical goods and services.
When Frank exports his mugs to London, that export goes into the current account. When American consumers buy millions of televisions imported from Japan, that goes into the current account.
The trade deficit that politicians argue about on the news, the fact that the U.S. imports far more physical goods than it exports, is just one specific metric sitting inside the current account.
So the current account is goods and services. The financial account tracks the cross-border flow of investments and assets.
This includes a U.S. corporation building a physical manufacturing plant in Mexico. But more importantly, it includes foreign entities buying U.S. stocks, real estate, and U.S. Treasury bonds.
Here is the absolute golden rule of the balance of payments and the conceptual aha moment that ties the global economy together. The balance of payments must mathematically equal zero. It always balances.
But wait. How is that possible when the U.S. runs a massive multi-trillion dollar trade deficit?
It's an inescapable accounting identity. Think about the mechanical flow of those dollars. American consumers send trillions of U.S. dollars to Japan and China to buy imported electronics and goods.
This creates a massive deficit in our current account.
But now, foreign central banks and corporations are sitting on a mountain of U.S. dollars. They cannot pay their local workers in dollars. Cash sitting in a vault earns nothing. What do they do with those trillions of U.S. dollars?
They invest them right back into the United States.
Exactly. They take those dollars and they buy U.S. Treasury bonds to earn a safe yield. They buy U.S. real estate. They invest in U.S. corporations.
That massive wave of money flowing back into the country creates a massive surplus in the financial account.
A deficit in the current account must be offset by a surplus in the financial account. The money always flows back into the system as capital investment.
That is mind-blowing when you truly understand the loop. Our consumption of foreign goods directly finances our government's deficit borrowing.
Before we wrap up our global tour, let's briefly touch on the extreme end of the risk spectrum, sovereign and geopolitical risk.
We discussed the risk of Frank the Founder defaulting on his corporate bonds. But what if Carla buys the bonds of an emerging market government and that sovereign nation defaults?
That is sovereign risk, and it's a unique beast. If Frank defaults, his bondholders drag him into federal bankruptcy court. A judge seizes Frank's factory, liquidates the robotics, and pays the bondholders.
There is a legal mechanism for recovery. But if a sovereign nation defaults on its debt, there is no international bankruptcy court you can call.
You cannot foreclose on a country. You cannot seize their infrastructure. Your recovery is entirely dependent on complex, highly politicized international debt restructuring negotiations.
And geopolitical risk scales even higher. This encompasses wars, sudden trade embargoes, or the nationalization of private assets.
If Frank builds a factory in a politically unstable country and the government suddenly decides to seize all foreign-owned assets, Frank loses his entire investment overnight.
These risks are systematic within those specific regions and can instantly wipe out both equity and fixed income returns.
Wow, we have covered an immense amount of ground. We've traced the plumbing from Frank's factory floor at the trough of the cycle, all the way to the Federal Reserve's balance sheet and out to international currency exchanges.
Tying the entire macroeconomic picture together for exam day is crucial. So we're going to do a rapid-fire recap of the absolute must-knows.
Do not just memorize these as isolated rules. Think about the causality we just spent the last hour breaking down. Let's punch out the core rules.
Time frames. A recession is two consecutive quarters of negative GDP. A depression is 6 quarters.
Indicators. GDP is coincident. CPI for services is lagging. The stock market is leading.
The doctors. A budget deficit is the result of expansionary fiscal policy by Congress. The Fed handles monetary policy using the dorm tools.
The curve. An inverted yield curve is the ultimate recession warning. Short-term rates are higher than long-term rates.
Currencies. A strong U.S. dollar is bad for foreign returns. It decreases your gains when you convert back to USD.
And credit spreads. Widening spreads indicate economic fear and an approaching recession. Narrowing spreads mean confidence.
I want to leave you with a final provocative thought to mull over based on everything we've read. We spent this entire deep dive treating the business cycle as a disease and the Federal Reserve and the government as the doctors trying to cure it.
But if we take that a step further and look at the actual causality loop, a paradox emerges. Think about the ultimate paradox of the business cycle.
At the bottom of the trough, the doctors use expansionary policy. They slash interest rates and run massive deficits to cure the contraction.
But flooding the system with cheap money eventually causes the economy to overheat. It essentially guarantees the massive inflation of the peak.
Right. And then to cure the inflation at the peak, the doctors are forced to use contractionary policy. They aggressively hike rates and drain cash,
which chokes off corporate borrowing and forces Frank to lay off Dan. This tight money policy essentially guarantees the next contraction.
The cure for the trough becomes the poison that causes the peak. And the cure for the peak becomes the poison that causes the trough.
By lowering rates to cure a contraction, they eventually cause the inflation that forces them to raise rates, which causes the next contraction.
By trying to fix the cycle, they essentially guarantee the next phase of the cycle will happen. Keep that interconnected loop in mind when you take your exam.
It really changes how you look at the news.
It does. Keep studying. Keep tracing that causality. Keep crushing those CertFuel practice exams. And we'll see you on the next deep dive.